Hey, you're listening to The Morning Show with Aaron, and on the line from Waikato Regional Council, I've got Rick Lefting. Good morning.
Morning, Aaron.
So, how are we doing? Are you at work already? I guess you must be, actually. What am I asking? It's 22 to 10. Yeah.
Although work can be quite fluid. I am actually in the office today, but you know, nowadays we can work from anywhere. So, but I am at work, yes.
Yeah, and so you're the Regional Resilience Team Leader. What does that mean in practice? What do you take care of?
Yeah, so our team has multiple facets. So we look at resilience holistically across the region, both in terms of responding to events such as flood events, understanding our natural hazard environment, so understanding how high water is going to get and providing guidance and advice to our district council colleagues and also to landowners as well. And we do that through a number of different means.
Yeah.
And we also then have, as part of that too, we have some very smart people who do a lot of modelling for us. And so we do hydraulic modelling as well. So we're just part of the regional resilience team that we're focused on, but we also tap into the wealth of information that we have here in the regional council that span, you know, most of the sciences and obviously the environment as well. So we have coastal scientists, we have ecologists, we have a whole range of expertise that can assist us when required.
Now, I think I saw your name attached to a press release recently from Regional Council about just how saturated the soils are in the region at the moment.
And, I don't think I need to tell the listeners how wet it has been over the last wee while. And in fact, it started back probably in the second half of last year, where we had rainfall for a lot of our sites that were above the average that we would normally get for the month. So coming up to the start of this year, we already had quite, you know, more saturated catchments than what we would normally expect. And then we had the three large weather events that hit pretty much most of the region, and that just compounded everything. And we're still seeing those impacts. And we're still, when because of the, again, continued saturation, although we have had a nice dry spell, thankfully, over the last week or so, our catchments are still quite vulnerable to any further rain. And what we don't know is, because of the, you know, the changes in the catchments, we don't know what those rain thresholds are where something might happen. So that's why we're quite cautious and taking a precautionary approach to just let people know that, hey, look, we're still vulnerable, and while we have had some dry spell, some further rain may cause some issues.
Yeah. And so for out here on this side of the deviation, that hasn't been such a big deal for us, but what has been a big deal is what's happening out at sea or coming into land. And we had this, I was quite alarmed by this number that the sea was 1.3 metres above its normal height at a certain time last month. And luckily it was it peaked at low tide, so it probably saved us from something much worse. But we have got a photo here, for instance, of the jetty at the bottom of Bow Street when the sea is basically up at the height of the jetty. And what I wanted to talk to you about was really how often does this happen and how much is it going to keep happening for the future?
The easy part is what's happened in the past.
Yes.
What's happening in the future, I think that's a harder question. But what we can tell is with the telemetry, i.e. the water level recorders we have around, it's really important that we have that information so we can look back and see quantitatively how high did the water get. And from that, we can look at what the likely frequency of and probability of those levels occurring again. So just to give some relativity, I'm sure a lot of people remember 2018 when we had another significant storm surge event. And in fact, the 2018 event was higher in terms of absolute water levels. So we talk about the difference between a storm tide, which is your absolute water level, and storm surge.
Yeah.
Your storm surge is your component that raises the water up. So back in 2018, the water level at Raglan reached just over 2.6 metres, and that's relative to Motariki vertical datum. So it's not a chart datum, it's another datum that we use in the region. And the event we had a few weeks ago got to about 2.45, so a little bit lower. However, it's like you said, it was that storm surge component that was larger, and we're lucky that it occurred at low tide.
Yeah, if that had happened at high tide and even worse at a king tide, I hate to think what would have resulted in that.
Well, that's right, you know, and I think one of the key aspects around that is the probability of that occurring, and you literally need all the stars to align, because obviously with king tides, where the king tides are driven by the moon and the sun,
yes,
and other specific tidal constituents, and they need to line up perfectly with a storm surge. That includes your storm surges, your low atmospheric pressure, and also the wave and wind setup on the west coast. And another phenomena which is related to the wind setup and wave setup is infragravity waves, which are very long period waves that come in. It's almost like a big surge. And I'm sure that, you know, during these high water events, people would have seen the surge coming in and then going out again. So you need to have all those things lining up to get those water levels.
Could you explain what the infragravity wave is?
Yeah, look, the infragravity waves, they're a longer period wave which originates, you know, obviously in the Tasman and in the Southern Ocean, and they're longer waves that you would normally see, such as generated by your shorter wind waves, and so they're longer period waves, and they just, with a longer period wave, there's more energy, and they come in, and they come in over the bar, and they cause a bit of a surge coming in, which comprises a little bit more of that inundation. However, you know, the what's called inverted barometer. So when you have, is also quite significant. And when you have a low pressure, the sea level along the coast rises.
Yeah.
Because you've got less pressure pushing down on it. And if we look at the comparison between the 2018 event and the one that's just recently, is the low point of that air pressure as the weather system came over the coast, the low point actually of pressure coincided almost identically with the peak high tide in 2018.
Right.
Whereas for this recent event, it actually peaked at the low tide. So again, that's one of the reasons why, luckily, we didn't get as high a tide.
So, and I gather that wind direction is a bit of an issue. Is that what you talk about, when the storm is pushing it in? Like, I had noticed if there was a northerly that it could push water across the harbour, but it sounds like what happened last month was more about the sea, the ocean, the Tasman Sea, being pushed into our coast. Is that kind of roughly what's happening?
Roughly, yeah. So when you have a strong and consistent wind coming into a coastline, you can. It's like how you blow across your cup of tea or coffee. That you, when you blow across the top of that, it goes over the top of the other side. So that's where you do get this constant pressure or push of wind on the water along the coast, and you get this local coastal set up as the water pushes up along the coastline. And you do get a little bit of that within the harbour as well. It's all through due to what's called fetch, which is the distance that wind can affect the water. So obviously when you're in the harbour, your longer fetch distances and are the areas that you're going to potentially get a little bit more wave action occurring on different parts of the coast, depending on that wave direction. So it's quite complicated, but also the timing and everything just needs to line up to get that, almost that perfect storm of all these different components aligning to get these large sea levels.
I suppose statistically that's unlikely, but also statistics would say at some point it probably will happen as well. Over a long enough time period, we should expect maybe worse events.
Well, that's it, you know, and I think that's one of the considerations around, you know, how often will this happen. And I think it's really good that you mentioned the statistics, because it's a probability. And what we look at, if we've done some rough calculations around offshore and Raglan, anyway, along the coast there, in terms of if we did have all of these stars aligned. You know, we had a king tide, or a highest astronomical tide where all the celestial bodies lined up. and with a large storm surge, then potentially we could get up to, you know, over 3 metres. So that's where, you know, we, like I said before, we got, you know, 2.65 in 2018 and 2.45 just recently. So you could maybe expect another, you know, half a metre or so potentially within the Raglan Harbour, which is, you know, which is reasonable. You know, unlikely, you know, the probability of that occurring is unlikely. However, we've seen them happen, you know, relatively frequently, you know, in 2018 and now. So not too long between those two events to get some significant sea levels. And also just remembering, even just on a king tide, some of our low-lying areas around Raglan do get inundated.
Yes, yeah, around Lorenza Bay, the houses around there, every time there's a king tide and it's windy, I think they worry. So, yeah. And do we have enough data? Does the data go back far enough that we can see that there is an increase in frequency in this kind of activity, or an increase in the power of it as well when they do come?
Yeah, we probably, you know, you mentioned before, the longer the record that we have, then obviously the more probability of getting these larger events. So for Raglan, we probably don't have as long a record as what we would like. But we do have some other sites, and not just within Raglan, but also up and down the west coast, not within our region, that we can get some insight there. I don't have that information on hand at the moment. But you know, that's why it's important that we do need to have consistent telemetry that's recording these, you know, these events, so that our future managers and our future communities have much better information to make decisions on.
I guess everyone feels like there's an increase in this sort of activity, and we're all expecting it with climate change. And it sounds like the issue with climate change is not so much that sea level is going to rise very, you know, slowly, incrementally, millimetre by millimetre, but that the storms will become more powerful and more often. So what are you guys kind of trying to prepare for the future, or what are your expectations for the future?
So yeah, look, there is still a lot of uncertainty around the climate change projections in terms of which, you know, greenhouse gas emissions scenario we globally go down. So there's still some uncertainty there, and then also around, you know, how more intense some of these storm events are going to be as well. So it's very much taking a precautionary approach, and, you know, taking a risk-based approach, but also an adaptive approach. So while we don't know exactly what sea levels and storm surge levels may be in the next, you know, 30, 40, 50, 100 years, we need to be looking at our communities in terms of, well, what may be impacted and when may they be impacted, and what signals and triggers do we need to reach to, you know, to start some adaptation change in terms of our community. So that's some work that Regional Council are working collaboratively with Waikato District Council on as well, just starting out in that process. So to get a better understanding around, you know, what assets we have, what values our communities have, and how they may be impacted in the future, and what and when, you know, change or adaptation may need to occur.
Yeah, and for some parts out here, retreat is clearly going to become necessary at some point. Well, unless we reverse climate change, I suppose.
When you were looking at the options, you look at all the options that are on the table and in your toolbox. You know, they range significantly in terms, and very, very site specific as well, in terms of what are the options. What's really important though is that the decisions on those options are based on good, sound technical information. And again, I go back around, you know, making sure that we are capturing the information now, so it gives our future managers and communities really good, robust information to make decisions on. But you know, taking into account, you know, what can we do now? Obviously, when you're looking at creating new land or subdivision, you know, those projections on climate change need to be factored in, so we don't, you know, so we ensure that we do keep resilient communities going forward. The difficulty is when we have existing communities, and what do we do then? And that's a discussion for all of us to come in on, you know, communities, district councils, regional councils, iwi, you know, it's a holistic approach to how we collectively manage these areas as best that we can, and have the information that our future communities and decision makers have to make those decisions.
And what's happening here is kind of the effect of it has been seen in coastal erosion, and we just, I don't know if you saw, there was, at least on our social media here in town last week or the week before, there was some erosion beside the airfield on the main inlet channel, and we're also talking about some erosion on the other side where the soccer fields are, and on a smaller inlet, probably caused by the change in the bridge that occurred in 2012 from town across to Papahua. So it's like it's been caught on both sides at the moment, and the question for our community is, do we try to prop up these areas, because there's not a lot of flat land in Raglan, so it's really handy to have all that the service we get from that there. Do we try to prop it up for a while with an expectation we might get a few more decades out of it, or do we give up now? You know, what do we do? And part of that question there is kind of what are we allowed to do along the coast as well? Are we allowed to put big walls and things like that, or is it just down to planting as a solution? Like, that's a whole discussion that's going on out here at the moment.
Oh, look, it's so complex in terms of both the coastal processes that are causing the erosion. You know, is it a short term cycle? Is it a long term cycle? You know, are we going to, you know, we know that those shorelines do fluctuate, you know, naturally as well, and you know, especially on the seaward side of Te Kopuas, but you know, that's right in the mouth, the dynamic area of Whangaroa Harbour.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of changes that occur there, and then how that, you know, how the sand effectively comes around the point and into the estuary as well. And you know, when you do change something in an environment like that, your shoreline wants to go back to some sort of equilibrium, and it doesn't take much of a change to get, you know, a impact. So whatever we do going forward, there is always going to be pros and cons, and I think that, you know, what I've been in this business for a while now, especially around coastal erosion and mitigation, and there really is no silver bullet. You know, there is no one answer that solves the problem.
Yeah.
And it's a matter of looking at the processes that are causing the erosion. What are they? The timescales, and looking at what options are technically available. And you know, one of the key considerations is, you know, soft or hard options. You know, soft options are your planting and your June restoration and replenishment. And then you've got your hard options, which are your groins, your seawalls, and we know that, you know, the hard options can cause, are effective in stopping erosion, but they also cause other detrimental benefits downstream as well, or, you know, adjacent to the coastline that you're trying to protect. So again, there's no one size fits all for these, and it changes around the coast as well. So it's around conversations, it's around understanding what are the values, what are the key things that the community hold dear, and understanding, if you do one option, what those pros and cons might be, or it might be a combination of options. And as I mentioned before, some of these options might have a short shelf life. They might only give you a little bit of time to then perhaps think a bit more or understand a bit more about the system to then look at the next options. But that, it's a very, very dynamic and challenging area to be in around coastal erosion management.
And if you create something, you're talking about the unknown effects of making a change. I imagine if you do something like create a seawall, that then waves will reflect off that, and is that a thing that happens? The swell reflects off and it causes a problem somewhere else in the harbour?
Yeah, and again, every site's going to be specific in terms of what those pros and cons are going to be for that type of structure, but definitely, you know, if you have any structure, you're going to get, you know, at the toe of the structure, you're going to get increased turbulence because the waves reflect off, come back, and so you get scour. But what you're also doing is you're effectively trapping sand in behind that seawall that would normally naturally travel along the shoreline, and so you're starving then another piece of the shoreline potentially as well.
Okay.
And again, it's understanding, what what changes to the system, the whole system that may occur. You know, it's definitely challenging in terms of understanding what those pros and cons are.
So, does the regional council have like a statement to coastal communities at this point about what you're expecting or what that we should be doing, or are you kind of working toward that? Like, yeah, what do you say when people come to you and say we're worried?
Oh, look, you know, I think it's around understanding the systems and communicating. You know, there is, one of the key concepts that we have around here is understanding what the issues are and again, what are those values and what are the options. And each site is going to be different. Like, there's no one statement that you say, hey, you can do this this option. But it's looking at the range of options as well. So it's starting those conversations. And, it's heartbreaking when we see individuals whose properties are being succumbed by nature. And coming up with options that are economically viable as well, not just environmentally or in terms of the impacts along the coast as well. We are also governed or restricted in terms of the consenting environment as well.
Yeah.
And there are things that to get a consent, you understand, again, you need to understand the impacts. Now, there is some change coming in from central government around some of the regional management resource management reforms coming through that are looking to take more of an adaptive management approach. So we don't know what that might look like, but again, you still fundamentally need to understand that any change to a coastal environment is going to have some impacts along the coastline as well.
Yeah, and have you been involved with the troubles that are happening up at Port Waikato at the moment?
I have, and again, that's one of the heartbreaking things is where people's
that's what I was thinking of.
People's lives have been significantly altered in terms of the buying a. Or having a house or a property that's been in your family for generations, and now you're losing that that value that you have, not just an economic value, but the memories you have had or were hoping to have in the future as well. And it really is heartbreaking. I mean, like I said, there's no one size fits all, no one silver bullet that can stop the stop that erosion.
And that's,
or to mitigate it effectively. Yeah.
Do we know the cause of that? Like, I haven't looked at it much, but I know that it's a quite a large dune area, and it's just been eaten back many, many meters to houses where they probably thought they were perfectly fine. They were too far from the water. We don't really have anywhere left like that around Raglan at the moment. But is that part of climate change, or is that part of the normal cyclical stuff that happens up and down the coast?
Yeah, that's a great question. And one of the things that we're looking at processes is the different scales that we need to be looking at. You know, we've just been talking about Raglan and some very, very site-specific areas that have, there's pockets of erosion or areas of erosion. But really, we need to start looking at the whole of the West Coast. And what we do know is one of the main features of the West Coast are the black sands, which is primarily titanomagnetite, which is a volcanic. Volcanic sediment, which is derived from Mount Taranaki, way down south. So we know that the majority of the sand that we have on the west coast has been derived from the Taranaki Bight and coming off Mount Taranaki and travels up the coast. What we don't know very well is while it travels from south to north and it travels or transported is by wave action, is that we don't know what cycles we have in terms of where the next slug of sand or how big the slug of sand is coming up the coast. Is there a slug of sand coming up the coast? Because when we have impediments to that flow, such as large river mouths or harbours, estuaries, and headlands, is that that sand sort of gets trapped in some of those places and needs a big storm event to then push it back up again. So we're a little bit unsure about whether we are in a how long this erosion cycle or this reduction in sediment budget or volume is at Port Waikato. We, you know, that's some research that we need to understand a bit better about. So that's where the main uncertainty is. You know, while we've had an erosion event, the erosion has occurred over the last few years. If we look at historically at shoreline growth at Port Waikato and for a lot of other areas in our region, is that there has been periods of growth, and so we have our coastal, our Waikato regional hazards portal that is available online, and anyone can look at that. And we have a coastal hazards tab that people can zoom in, and you can actually see where the shorelines were historically.
Okay.
And at Port Waikato, the shoreline is currently now around about where it was in the 1940s. And so you can see that since the 1940s, actually even before that, that spit has been growing and building. And then some years ago, I think it was maybe around the 2013-14 area, around there sort of somewhere, then we've had this reduction and an erosion phase that's occurred since then. So, it's a natural phenomenon. And it's something that we just don't know a lot about at this stage.
Right, but that's you're talking about potentially an 80-year cycle or larger.
I can't put a number on it. You know, I think that we don't have that type of information.
But I guess my point is the cycles are like multi-decade cycles like that big.
Oh, and maybe even bigger.
You know,
one of the other things that we know further up the coast at Piha is some work research that was done a number of years ago was looking at that Piha embayment, and over geological scales that Piha embayment had been emptied out and then refilled with sand a few times over the last few thousand years. Historically, over geological time frames, the sea levels rose to around about where they were around about 6,000 years ago. So over the last 6,000 years, the sea levels have been around about where they are. And so within those geological scales, we've seen some quite large changes in sediment volume, potentially, particularly on the west coast.
Yeah, and the area we're talking about at Papahua Te Kopo over here is, that's just sandbank. And now I'm curious to know what, over the last 6,000 years, how much that has changed. But I don't, it depends whether anyone's done any research or not.
Yeah, I can't remember exactly what's been done there, but again, what we do know, if you look at the geology, is that there are some hard competent geology within that area. There's a mixture of the soft sand, obviously, but you've also got good, mainly volcanic material there that is very resistant to flows. And what we can see, and again, if people want to go on to our coastal hazards tab in our regional hazards portal, you can see that at the around about where the toilet block is on just west or at the harbour mouth there, you can see that the shoreline's been very, very stable in that point there, because there is a hard structure there underneath, and you've got a sand veneer over top, so the sand sort of comes and goes, but you've got this hard structure underneath. Where you move further into the harbour, you don't have that hard structure, and it is primarily sand geology, which obviously, as we know, is quite quite vulnerable to change and is not as sturdy as the hard competent material.
Yeah. Hey, Rick, look, it's been really good talking to you this morning. We're out of time, actually, well over time, but I wanted to have the conversation, so appreciate your time. Yeah. And you've left me with a lot of questions still, but I guess that's the nature of the beast, really, with this, isn't it?
It is, but I think for the wrangling community, there are some very, very knowledgeable people within your community who work for a number of agencies and organisations and companies that, coastal processes and hazards are their bread and butter.
Yeah.
And I think, we do have some very, very good expertise and resource available within the Raglan community as well. So again, it's a community approach to understanding how these systems have occurred in the past, but how they may evolve into the future, and collectively and holistically what are the options available to us.
Yeah, yeah. All right, look, thanks for your time, and I'll let you get back to your main job now.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much, Aaron.
See ya. Okay, folks, yes, that was Rick Lefting there at Waikato Regional Council, the Regional Resilience Team Leader. Probably after talking to him, you now understand what that job title means. I don't know who comes up with job titles at councils these days, but they kind of like that. And I'm sure that means something internally, but it's a little bit hard. Resilience Manager, I want to call him. But Team Leader is the title. Anyway, that's that. That's the end of the show for the day. I've gone over a bit late, but I'm going to have to edit this down for the repeat tomorrow morning. Don't forget, later today, the Raglan Community Board is meeting. We haven't even talked about that on the show this morning. Been so busy with interviews. But 1:30 in the Town Hall Supper Room is the open forum. You're going to be hearing about the bus. I know the people are there to talk about fluoride in the open forum, probably. They'll get about 5 minutes, I think. And then Kane, who I talked to yesterday, is going to be talking about the fluoride issue, 6:30. At the Congregational Church Hall on Stewart Street tonight. See you all again tomorrow morning.